From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We woke up to the possibility of peace in the Persian Gulf after a Radio Baghdad communique indicated Iraq was willing to withdraw from Kuwait. But after all the conditions for withdrawal were stated, the offer was rejected by President Bush. On this edition of Fresh Air, we speak with someone who thinks a lot about the end of the war. Laith Kuba is an Iraqi dissident living in London, and he's the leader of the London-based group, the Democratic Reform Movement in Iraq. We'll discuss his view of the Iraqi offer and the feasibility of democracy in a post-Saddam Iraq. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Most allied leaders have now rejected the conditions attached to Iraq's offer to withdraw from Kuwait. Now, diplomatic observers are looking for elements in the offer that might serve as a beginning for some new peace initiative. British Prime Minister John Major said the offer shows, at least, that Saddam Hussein realizes that he must withdraw from Kuwait before the war can end. Soviet Foreign Minister Alexander Besmertnik said the offer was an important beginning. He said he'll seek clarification when he meets with Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz next week in Moscow. President Bush paid a visit today to the Raytheon Corporation in Massachusetts to congratulate the workers who build the Patriot missile. The president used his visit to respond to Iraq's offer to withdraw from Kuwait. Anthony Brooks of member station WBUR reports.
Despite a series of problems during its 25 years of development, the Patriot missile is touted by the Bush administration as one of the great success stories in the Gulf. The president was here today to capitalize on that, calling the Patriot proof positive that missile defense works. As part of his Star Wars program, the president wants to triple the funding for the Patriot in next year's budget. Mr. Bush was also here to reject again Saddam Hussein's offer to leave Kuwait as a cruel hoax.
Let me state once again, Iraq must withdraw without condition. There must be full implementation of all the Security Council resolutions, and there will be no linkage to other problems in the area.
President Bush speaking to employees at the Raytheon Corporation in Andover, Massachusetts. For National Public Radio, this is Anthony Brooks.
U.S. military officials in Saudi Arabia said today that despite Iraq's announced intention to withdraw, the allies will continue their bombing campaign. From Riyadh, Deborah Wong reports.
At the daily briefing in Riyadh, Brigadier General Richard Neal announced there will be no change in the campaign until the president orders it. Neal also said that allied forces would continue to attack Iraqi forces even if they appeared to be moving north out of Kuwait. However, Neal said that personally he was encouraged by Iraq's announcement. It was the first time Iraq had mentioned the possibility of withdrawal, he said, and if that's the result of the campaign, that's great. Neal said that there was an initial blush of optimism in the war room today as Allied commanders got word of the Iraqi offer, but he said, we're in the business of executing the war, and the Iraqis have disappointed us before. I'm Deborah Wong in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
The all-clear has sounded in Riyadh after an air raid alert. U.S. military sources said they had unconfirmed reports of a missile being fired into Saudi Arabia's eastern province. Reports from Dahran said that no missiles have been fired into that area. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 57 points today to close at 2,934.65. This is NPR News. Reports from Baghdad said that ordinary Iraqis reacted happily to their government's announcement that it was willing to withdraw from Kuwait. In a report cleared by Iraqi censors, the Associated Press said that people ventured out into the streets to express relief at the prospect of ending the war. The report said that Allied bombing resumed on the outskirts of the city about 8 hours after the Iraqi announcement. The attack was said to have come as a surprise to many Iraqis who'd hoped the withdrawal proposal would end the Allied bombardment. A newly formed peace group in Seattle says today's conditional offer by Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait should be used by the U.S. to negotiate an end to the Gulf War. From Seattle, Carol Levinson reports.
Professionals for Peace is a small group of business people who oppose the war but say they want to express their opposition in a way other than protest marches and demonstrations. In the words of one member, the group is, quote, tired of the perception that the only people behind peace are unemployed students with orange mohawks, end quote. Glenn Gersmell, director of Washington State Sane Freeze and an expert on international security, spoke to the group today and in an interview beforehand said the U.S. should seriously consider Iraq's conditional withdrawal offer.
I think that today's developments open up a window for international pressure and the public to say to Bush, move toward negotiation. I don't think Bush will go there on his own.
Gersmell says even the peace movement does not accept Iraq's offer to pull out of Kuwait with all of the current conditions attached. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson in Seattle.
California Governor Pete Wilson announced a 5-point plan today for dealing with his state's drought, warning residents that there was hardship ahead. The governor's measures for coping with the crisis included statewide water rationing, the creation of a water bank, and establishment of a $100 million fund for conservation measures. Wilson said that most Californians will have to cut their water use by half. The water bank would buy water and sell it to those who need it most. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today began with the news of Iraq's communique that it was willing to withdraw from Kuwait. It soon became clear the withdrawal was conditional and unacceptable to President Bush. But the Soviets have called the Iraqi initiative a positive development. When this war does end, what are the chances for democracy in Iraq? My guest, Laith Kuba, is an Iraqi dissident living in exile in London, where he heads an opposition group called the Democratic Reform Movement. It's a pressure group that is developing a plan for a democratic political system, plans that would be too dangerous to discuss in Saddam's Iraq. Kuba moved to England in 1976 to earn a doctorate at the City University of London. But when Saddam Hussein became president of Iraq in 1979, Kuba decided to remain in London. I spoke with him earlier today from the NPR Bureau in London and asked him about his reaction to the Iraqi offer to withdraw.
The proposal itself is very much welcomed. I doubt very much that it will result into a withdrawal. There are many reasons. Saddam at the moment is in a strong position internally. I think a lot of the public anger is directed towards the Americans and the Allied. And I think by giving that gesture of peace, he appears to be very much like a peaceman rather than like the cause of the war itself. So I think it's very much a tactic that is very well played. And the end result, it'll put more pressure on the Allied rather than on himself.
So you see it basically as a more of a public relations move to help boost his image more than anything else.
I think there are two sides to it, I must point out. I think when I listened to the Russian envoy mediating, the Russians are in Iraq's very good office. They have very good relationships. They have never been involved in Iraq with the war. They've been allies. For all these reasons, if anybody wanted to do the mediating at the moment between Iraq and the United States, I think it'll be Russia itself, the Soviet Union. And hence, their involvement on one hand indicates there is more to it than purely a posture. But on the other hand, I think Iraq has been and is at the moment desperate to find an end to this war. And hence, he is getting the Russian involved in doing the mediation for him.
If Iraq did withdraw now or in the near future from Kuwait, do you think that that would be good or bad for the future of Iraq? Because Saddam Hussein would still be in power and he'd be more popular than ever.
Well, the war has not been good for Iraq at all. I think an end to the war is a good thing. Getting Saddam out of power is totally a different issue. We have argued in the past that by having a direct war with Iraq, it will not necessarily yield to ousting Saddam out of power. So I think the issue of Saddam Hussein remains on its own right. By withdrawing now or by ending the war now, his chances of survival are stronger than before the war.
And how do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, we're quite happy to see an end to the war and hostilities. I think to us, this at the moment is more of a danger. I think there are enough forces within the country to remove Saddam Hussein. If those forces were to be approached in the right way, then they can be unleashed and they can destabilize his grip over the country. This has not been the case. The war itself has consolidated his grip over issues and over the country.
Who do you see as those forces that could help dislodge him from power?
Well, you can look at the immediate forces that are surrounding him is the Iraqi army itself. Now, the Iraqi army is overlooked by what is called the political bureau and by the security forces themselves. The security forces themselves, which comes from the immediate tribe of Saddam Hussein, they have a great say in events, and so long as they see him as the only savior or protectorate for their interests, I think they'll rally behind him. So those two forces are the immediate ones. It is unlikely that the people in Iraq will rise en masse against Saddam Hussein. The reason being, he has threatened and he carried out threats of using the chemical gas against them. So I don't think the people will rise en masse. And if any move was to appear, it has to appear from either the security forces or from the Iraqi army itself.
Well, how likely do you think the security forces or the army would be to really turn on him?
During the war, it's unlikely because nobody can guess whether that move will improve their chances or it'll make it worse. But I think if there was no war, as it happened at the end of the Iraq-Iran war, a lot of people were optimistic and they were looking to forces within the Iraqi establishment to move to oust Saddam Hussein. In my opinion, the reason why Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, part of the reason, is to give himself that extra space. Otherwise, he was very much cornered by internal problems and by forces within the country.
Laith Kuba is my guest. He's the head of a pro-democracy movement of Iraqi exiles based in London. It's called the Democratic Reform Movement. Now, your group's goal is to establish democracy in Iraq. Do you see the war as ultimately helping your goals?
The war itself will leave us with far more problems to tackle than the conditions were in Iraq before the war started. But we are realists. We know that the lack of democracy and the lack of stability in Iraq has been a long-standing issue. In the past, I think that superficial stability that existed in Iraq through the use of force and by having a dictator like Saddam Hussein has been of some benefit to the regional powers, but it has never been of benefit to the Iraqi people themselves. So I think an end to Saddam Hussein does not necessarily mean the establishment of democracy, and it would require an awful lot of work from our side.
Do you think there are a lot of would-be tyrants waiting in the wings to take over if Saddam Hussein is ousted?
Yes. You see, the reform that is needed in Iraq is not purely to do with the person of Saddam Hussein. I think it's to do with the role of the army in running the state. It's to do with the narrowly based power that exists in Iraq, which is primarily from one segment of the Iraqi society, the Arab Sunni tribes. It's to do with the lack of participation of the masses of the Arab Shias and the Kurds. And I think unless those issues are tackled, we are likely to end up with another army officer or with another dictator. And hence, we are postponing the problem for another 5 years before we face the problem again. The essence of Iraq's problem is the lack of an accountable government. If we have a representative government in Iraq which is accountable to its people, then the people will not allow the government to venture or misadventure into wars with neighboring countries or with any other issues in the region.
When the war is over, would you like to see Western or Arab forces remaining in Iraq?
Iraqi people are very proud people. I don't think they'll welcome that aspect at all. In fact, they are very suspicious of what is going on at the moment. They see very much that the effort of the Allied are not to do with Kuwait, but to do with weakening Iraq. And I don't think the Arab forces or the Allied forces will be welcomed at all in Iraq, in future Iraq. So I don't think it's a good idea.
What are your concerns about how a settlement might look when the war is over?
A settlement between?
A settlement between Iraq and the coalition forces.
I think the key to the problem we've argued in the past is Saddam Hussein himself at the moment has given himself the privilege and the right to decide when and where to go to war. We believe that removing him from power is an essential step for instability to exist in the region. By getting him out of Kuwait and having Saddam staying in power, we're only delaying further problems to occur. So the real problem must be by ousting Saddam Hussein from power and establishing a representative government. If we do that, I think the Iraqi people are very peaceful people. They do not want to venture into other people's territories. I think there is enough credibility within the country. There are enough cultured and civilized people to run the country in a very modern fashion. So I do not see the future as being bleak, especially if there is goodwill from other regional countries to see a stable Iraq in the region.
Are you concerned that countries in the coalition forces will want things from Iraq for their own future, will maybe even want to change the boundaries of Iraq and take a little piece of it for themselves?
We're all concerned about such moves. We are very concerned about Iraq being exposed to outside influence and outside interference. But Iraq is not like Lebanon. The region cannot afford to see an unstable Iraq. If Iraq was unstable, it'll bring the whole region down with it. If we allow borders to be altered, then where do you stop? The legitimacy of the borders throughout the region will be questioned and reviewed. And I think the logic of force and might will become very much right. So I think the world cannot afford to see instability taking place in Iraq, and hence there must be some form of international goodwill to maintain the sovereignty and the stability of Iraq.
Nath Kuba, you are the head of a group called the Democratic Reform Movement. It's based in London. Tell us a little bit about the goals of the group and who belongs to it.
Primarily, Iraq has been dominated in the last 20 years by a ruthless government that did not allow any pressure group or any democratic form of expression to surface. So we left up with very much groups of opposition that are ideological in their orientation, that are radical in their demands, and who survived the era of Saddam Hussein, not inside the country, but basically by having groups outside the country. Our argument is that once the Iraqi people are given a chance to express their views, their immediate demands will be to see reform, political reform in particular, in the country. We are trying, our group had surfaced amongst the exiled Iraqi community in London. We have links with other exiled communities of Iraqis in Canada, in Scandinavian countries, in Iran, in Syria. And we are focusing on that sole issue, is to see political reform taking place in the country, tackling the issue of having a representative government, accommodating the dual nationality of Iraq as a country, curing the illnesses that exist within the state of Iraq, cutting down the role of the Iraqi army and its role in politics, and ensuring that pluralism will exist in future Iraq. So we are very much a watchdog. We are sponsored by the people themselves. We believe that we've got a role to play. We want to make sure that the Iraqi opposition themselves will not become a new tyrant in the region. And hence, we must ensure that the transfer of power would take place in Iraq.
Well, what kinds of other opposition groups are there in exile now? Are there other groups that you're in conflict with?
Well, I do not see ourselves in conflict with anybody other than, at the moment, the immediate regime of Saddam Hussein himself. We are aware that once Saddam goes, there will be remains of the previous system in Iraq. There will still be a Ba'ath party, there will still be an army, and there will still be a privileged Arab Sunni tribes. And we believe they've got a role to play in future Iraq, but not to be a dominant force and not to have an exclusive right over others. We are aware that there are a Muslim fundamentalist group. The Islamic phenomena had swept not only Iraq, but the whole of the Middle East. And I think that desire will be naturally accommodated if there was to be a democratic system in Iraq. We are aware that many, many Kurdish parties are reflecting the aspiration of the Kurdish people to have some form of self-administration and autonomy. And I think that is respected and accepted. And there are many other nationalist and leftist groups that are willing to participate within a democratic Iraq. We do not see ourselves in conflict with political groups. However, having said that, I think the journey to make everybody believe and practice democracy is going to be a long one.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Laith Kuba. He's the head of a group of Iraqi exiles called the Democratic Reform Movement. This is a group based in London, a pro-democracy group. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Laith Kuba is my guest. He is the general secretary of the Democratic Reform Group, a group of Iraqi dissidents, exiles. He's speaking to us from the NPR Bureau in London. Now, how much power, realistically, do you think that an exile group like yours is going to have when Saddam Hussein is out of power? And I ask this in the context that there's a lot of countries with their own agendas, when Saddam Hussein is out.
Right. We are aware that the Iraqi masses themselves, the 17 million Iraqis, have been left out of politics for quite a long time. Now, everybody talks on behalf of the Iraqi masses, and they claim that they represent them. We do not claim we represent the people. The only those people who will be elected in the future are the only ones who can truly represent the Iraqi people. However, we are all competing, or we're trying to read the interests and the demands of the Iraqi people and adopt them and reflect them. So do many other political parties, perhaps with one exception. The other parties have more of, as I said, ideological issues on their minds. The nationalists look at Arab nationalism. The Kurdish groups look at a local agenda for the Kurds, but not as a national agenda for the whole of Iraq. The Muslim fundamentalist groups look at the issue of Islam and Islamic reform. So we, I think, are different in a sense. We identify that what the people of Iraq would like to see is a stable, modern Iraq of which they can live with some freedom and dignity, and they can exercise their wishes on who to represent. We do not believe that the people of Iraq will be radical in their demands, will be extremist. So our agenda is primarily for the average Iraqi in the street. The problem that we are likely to face is that Iraq as a country will be exposed to outside influence. There is a potential outside influence from Iran, Syria, and Saudi Arabia, and all of which might be counterproductive and might destabilize Iraq rather than enhance its stability.
Can you share a little bit of your vision of what a democratic Iraq might look like?
We'd like to see self-administration or local administration. We'd like to see not only people in Kurdistan electing their representative and administrating their affairs. We'd like to reflect that phenomena throughout Iraq. We'd like to see proportional representation so that the majority in Iraq will not dominate minorities. Iraq is a very heterogeneous community of many ethnic origins, many religions, and many small groups of special interests. I think proportional representation will ensure that they will have a say in a form of a parliament or a house of representatives. So self-administration, we'd like to see proportional representation. We'd like to have, of course, national elections that people can elect directly a middle-of-the-road agenda or a party. We'd like as well to see reforms taking place so that the people will not be bundled into a system that they cannot understand. We'd like to see reform in particular amongst the Kurds and amongst the Arab Shias, who are in the middle and south of Iraq. So all these measures are needed. We need to see a goodwill restored between the various communities in Iraq.
Do you envision a secular or an Islamic government?
No, we visualize that the future is going to be for a secular government for a simple reason. Although the majority of the people in Iraq are Muslims, I think Iraq itself is composed, as I said, of Kurds and Arabs, or some Arabs who are Sunnis, and a good 55% of other Arabs who are Shias. Now, you can't run an Islamic state with too many different schools of thoughts. There must be a central figure. And we believe that the first demand the people would like to see is some reform and some stability. So I do not think that people will rush into having an Islamic state without seeing exactly what these programs will mean for them.
Do you think that Saddam Hussein is becoming more popular now in Iraq? And do you think that that might make the work of democracy more difficult?
Up until, I think, the invasion of Kuwait, and perhaps immediately after the invasion of Kuwait, I think Saddam Hussein has been the most hated person in Iraq. But the people are helpless. They lost faith in what the opposition can do. They lost faith in what neighboring countries can do. And they lost faith that the world community would ever come to rescue them or help them in their misfortune with Saddam Hussein. But having said that, I think once Saddam Hussein is out of power, Iraq must be engaged immediately, or in fact, Iraq must be engaged right from now into a different state of affairs. Iraqis must look at the future with hope. If we want the people of Iraq to be positive, we must engage them in a different frame of mind. They must look at the future, at reconstruction, at reform, at hope. They must look to the future, and they mustn't look back, and they mustn't be entrenched with that fear and that helplessness that dominated them all these years.
There's a statement issued by your group, the Democratic Reform Movement in Iraq, and within that statement it says, reform cannot become reality without the active involvement of Iraqi masses in the future of the country. Saddam's era created a fearful, withdrawn citizen with neither values nor democratic institutions to participate in constructing Iraq. The rehabilitation of the Iraqi citizen and Iraq's community is vital for future reforms. What do you have in mind when you talk about the rehabilitation of the Iraqi citizen?
I think people must come out of their shells. They must come out of that big fear. And nobody's guessed. They've been ruled by fear for quite a long time. And once they are let loose and once they are let to express themselves, I think it'll take quite a while to rehabilitate those new practices. Religion here, in that respect, Islam, I think will play a positive part. It'll be a good force that will encourage people. It'll give them some simple slogans in a very painful and difficult situation. So I think, in a sense, Islam can be a good harmonizing force if it was handled, of course, by in the right way, by the right people. I think people must be encouraged to participate. That's the reason when I talked about local administration, it's a practice that needs to be spread throughout the country. Rebuilding Iraq must be a process by which the whole of the Iraqi people must feel the immediate benefit of. And all these things will transfer them to a different state of mind.
Laith Koba is an Iraqi exile living in London. He heads a dissident group called the Democratic Reform Movement. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I'll talk with Koba about his life in exile in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the life of an Iraqi dissident in exile. Laith Kuba heads an opposition group based in London called the Democratic Reform Movement in Iraq. He'll tell us why and how he left Iraq and what he hopes for when he returns. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush says he and other allied leaders agree an Iraqi peace proposal has nothing new in it, with the possible exception of recognizing for the first time that Iraq must leave Kuwait. Radio Baghdad said this morning it is prepared to get out of Kuwait, but added that this would have to be accompanied by a return by Israel of all occupied territories and a pullout of allied troops from the Middle East. Mr. Bush said this afternoon, at a missile plant in Massachusetts, that there will be no linkage to problems in the Gulf area. The question of whether Iraqi troops withdrawing from their positions would be attacked by Allied forces drew a number of different answers during this afternoon's Pentagon briefing. NPR's Vicki O'Hara explains.
There was some confusion over what would happen to Iraqi troops trying to withdraw in the process of withdrawal. Reporters kept asking Pentagon spokesmen over and over again if the Iraqi troops came out of their foxholes and their dug-in positions, if they would be attacked by U.S. and Allied forces. At first, the answer was yes, and then at the end of the briefing, Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams came back and said that the Iraqis would not necessarily be attacked. He said that clearly we want them to withdraw, and clearly we would not attack if they are withdrawing. However, that contradicted everything we heard earlier today.
NPR's Vicki O'Hare reporting from the Pentagon. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater has publicly reprimanded the Israeli ambassador to Washington for comments made against the Bush administration yesterday. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
Israeli Ambassador Zalman Shoval had accused the U.S. of giving Israel the runaround on its request for loan guarantees needed to help build housing for Soviet Jewish immigrants. Shoval said his government has given the U.S. all the information it requested on the resettlement programs, but each time the U.S. demands more. Shoval also complained that Israel has received no compensation for losses it has suffered as a result of the Gulf War. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater called the accusation outrageous and outside the bounds of acceptable behavior by the ambassador of a friendly country. We deserve better from Israel's ambassador, Fitzwater said. The spokesman added that President Bush protested Shoval's remarks to Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir by cable. I'm Richard Gonzalez with the president in Kennebunkport, Maine.
A number of young people angry over the Allied bombing of Iraq went over the walls of the UN headquarters in Algiers today and ripped down the UN flag. Other young people attacked the airline offices of Italy and Egypt, smashing windows and ripping out telephones. These attacks came after a pro-Iraqi march by some 30,000 Algerians. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 57 points to close at 2,934.65 on volume of some 222 million shares. Trading today was very heavy. This is NPR News. U.S. military officials in Saudi Arabia say Iraq launched a missile attack on the industrial port city of Jebal a short while ago. The statement gave no details of the number of missiles fired in the attack or whether any had hit the city, site of a huge petrochemical complex. Earlier, a U.S. military official said that it appeared at least one missile had been fired into northeastern Saudi Arabia, somewhere near the front line. The next move in Persian Gulf diplomacy is a visit to Moscow this weekend by Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz. The Soviets will try to find out what is behind Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's conditional offer to pull out of Kuwait, and the State Department will keep a close eye on the proceedings. Barry Schweid has more.
Secretary of State James Baker talked twice this week by telephone to Soviet Foreign Minister Alexander Pasmertnik. The second call was placed by Baker hours after Baghdad announced the offer to withdraw from Kuwait, which President Bush denounced as a cruel hoax. According to U.S. officials, Bismarck assured Baker the Soviet Union is insisting on Iraqi compliance with all 12 U.N. Security Council resolutions, including unconditional withdrawal. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler, meanwhile, offered no public advice to Moscow. It's not our meeting, she said. But, she added, we wish anyone well who can get Saddam Hussein to abide by the U.N. resolutions. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
In Moscow, a Soviet government official says that the Soviet Union will help people deal with a planned increase in retail prices by raising salaries and benefits and cutting taxes on business. The chairman of the State Committee on Labor told the Communist Party Daily Pravda that taxes on profits will be cut from some 35% to 45%. In trading in Europe, the dollar moved sharply higher against other major currencies. Gold prices were down. I'm Ann Taylor, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. One of the most widely read books about Iraq is Republic of Fear, written by an Iraqi exile under the pen name Samir al-Khalil. He writes about the lack of Arab intellectual opposition to Saddam Hussein. He describes, quote, the terrible silence of the intelligentsia inside and outside the Arab world, a silence which is in such stark contrast to the clear voices of their counterparts in Latin America or Eastern Europe. No Arab versions of Václav Havel or Christa Wolff have called Saddam Hussein to account. My guest, Laith Kuba, is an Iraqi intellectual and dissident living in London. He's the co-founder of the opposition group the Democratic Reform Movement, a group that is planning for a future democracy in post-Saddam Iraq. I spoke with him earlier today from the NPR Bureau in London and asked him if he agreed with Samir al-Khalil about the silence of Arab intellectuals on the subject of Saddam Hussein.
Not really. I disagree with that statement. I witnessed since 1979 in particular the outcry of many, many Iraqis. It started initially at universities in 1979 when Saddam took power. And in fact, before Saddam took power in April 1979, there has been demonstrations. There has been many, many arrests. I think the records of Amnesty International is a good testimony of the number of students, for example, who protested, university students, and they ended up being executed. Hundreds of them are on the Amnesty International's list. So I do not believe that the intelligentsia in Iraq have been silent. However, I do believe that they are facing an extraordinary phenomena of a dictator. They faced it very much with primitive methods. They used the pen, they used the paper, the odd group became revolutionary, but none of them was clever enough to work out the system, how it works, to try to dislodge Saddam Hussein from his international support that used to come from East Europe, from Europe, and later from America. I think the Iraqi intelligentsia and the Iraqi opposition had failed its duty, but this is not due to lack of effort. I think it's primarily due because they're facing an extraordinary phenomena in the rule of Saddam Hussein.
What are some of the difficulties for you of being an Iraqi exile, a dissident one, trying to organize a democracy for the future of Iraq? Do you feel like you're in physical danger or that family or friends left behind in Iraq are because of your actions?
Well, I must say that the line we're taking is not that radical. It hasn't been that radical. We are not plotting to assassinate Saddam Hussein. We are not involved in any armed activities. And I don't think we are seen by Saddam Hussein as an immediate threat. Now, following what happened to Ceausescu in Romania and following the collapse of the communist rule in East Europe, I think Saddam Hussein recently started to realize the danger of having democratic movements, and it can be the real threat coming from the back door as far as he's concerned. So in that respect, yes, I think we have become recently more aware that our innocent slogans can perhaps be more terrifying to Saddam Hussein than lots of the radical slogans of the opposition. And yes, I mean, recently, as I've taken a public profile and as I've started speaking openly, demanding those reforms, we started in February 1990 by making a public appeal for democracy and human rights in Iraq. And I think that appeal was not received well by Iraq at all. It created some tension that ended up with the execution of the Observer reporter Bazov. And I think things started from there. We started that appeal in London. And I think Saddam Hussein saw that appeal coming from London as a big conspiracy against him.
Do you think that you have been followed or your phones have been tapped or have you been threatened or harassed in any way?
In the past, yes. I mean, we've been monitored very much by the agents of Saddam Hussein in London. As you might know, that they had a free hand in London up until very recently. But since the invasion of Kuwait, I think there has been many expulsions. Their network here operating in Britain has been cut down significantly. And I think they have more things to worry about at the moment than ourselves. But if things go back to the old days, then obviously I'll be very worried about my own security.
What do you mean when you say that the Iraqis had a free hand in London until the invasion of Kuwait?
Well, up until the invasion of Kuwait, I think from 1978, 79, up until 1990, Iraq has not exercised any violent activities in Britain. And in return, it had the freedom of many of its agents to operate openly. They've penetrated the opposition, they've monitored what we do, they basically compile a lot of data, but they, for some reason, they were not engaged in any subversive activities in London.
My guest is Laith Kuba, an Iraqi living in exile in London, where he co-founded the Iraqi dissident group, the Democratic Reform Movement. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Kuba is my guest, and he's an Iraqi exile living in London and the general secretary of a pro-democracy movement called the Democratic Reform Movement, a movement that hopes to see democracy established in Iraq. You moved to London in 1976 to study. Why did you decide to stay?
I started and I finished my PhD on schedule. But it coincided, as I was writing my PhD in civil engineering, it coincided with Saddam taking over in Iraq in 1979. And I think he started, as I've mentioned earlier in the program, a wave of terror and execution to the intellectuals and to the intelligentsia in Iraq. That touched many of my friends, many of my associates at the university. And from that time, I started lobbying openly against his rule and against the violations of human rights. When the Iraq-Iran war started in 1980, I lobbied openly for years against the war. And I think for all these reasons, since 1979, it put me in danger. And of course, I couldn't go back to Iraq, otherwise I'll be threatening my life.
Did you lose many friends in the Iran-Iraq war?
I lost many friends, not only in the Iraq-Iran war, but even in 1979, 1980. Many of the people who I know, who are very, very peaceful people, but who are people with dignity and integrity, spoke against Saddam Hussein taking power. My own brother was arrested and tortured, and the rest of the family suffered the consequences of it. And as I said, during the Iraq-Iran war, the whole country was pulled into that tragedy that ended up, again, with no benefit to the people at all, except Saddam emerging as a stronger person with a stronger army.
If you had been in Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war, would you have been required to fight to join the military?
Yes, national service is compulsory on all Iraqis, whether they're graduates or not. But I would have thought if I was in Iraq, because I was an independent person and because I have not joined the Ba'ath Party and I've been critical of it to some degree, I would definitely would have been seen as a potential threat and a potential enemy. And in Iraq, that was good enough to eliminate a person or arrest him. So obviously, if I was in Iraq, I would have not had the chance to be alive today and say what I'm saying.
So you think you'd more likely be in prison or dead than in the military even?
Yes, and in fact, there are still many, many people who, some of them who taught me at the College of Engineering in Baghdad University, who were arrested in 1980, and nothing has been heard of them up until this moment. So nobody knows whether those hundreds or thousands of people are still alive or they are dead, because nothing has been heard of them since.
When you left Iraq in 1976 to study in England, what did you think of Saddam Hussein at the time? He wasn't the head of the state yet, but he was still pretty powerful.
Saddam Hussein was seen as becoming the first man rather than the second man since 1973. There was an attempted coup against him, which he foiled, and he set up his own security forces, his own intelligence forces that overlooked the whole state. And since 1973, many people saw him as being really the man, the power behind the throne. And what happened in 1979 when he took over power was just removing a tiny piece of cover or a mask, and he showed himself as being the real power then.
When did you start to think of yourself as a dissident?
In 1979, I think I spoke at various universities, and I started contacting Amnesty International and supplying them with a lot of data. But in 1980, I was part of initially I was studying engineering, and like all Iraqi students who live in Britain, they have their files with the embassy, and I was my file was cancelled at the embassy, and I received a small note asking me to cancel my studies and return back to the country immediately, which obviously I've realized that things have gone wrong and now I cannot go back to Iraq.
What kind of emotional reaction did you get when you received that letter?
Well, at that time, I was, I think, very concerned about the developments that were taking place inside Iraq itself. I was extremely saddened by the news that so many people have been executed, very much the elite of the Iraqi society, the best people who I can think of, who can be in Iraq and serve Iraq, those people have been eliminated. And of course, I was very saddened. So when my little bit of pain came, it didn't bother me that much. I was far more concerned with what was going on back home.
It seems that London has become an important center for Iraqi exiles. Can you explain why a relatively high number of Iraqi exiles have settled in England?
I think traditionally Britain has been the ex-colonialist power in Iraq, and it had strong, relatively speaking, strong cultural ties with Iraq. My father studied in Britain. I think a lot of people do their education in Britain, and it is very much seen as the first step that one takes to the outside world is by coming and being studying in Britain or being part of it. And that has continued from, I think, 50s and the 60s. I must mention, for example, when tension rose between the Iraqis, between the Arabs and the Jews, generally speaking, in the Middle East, many Iraqi Jews have immigrated and came to Britain, and there is today a good 4,000 Iraqi Jews who form a very strong community here. But the real escalation in numbers of Iraqis started during the Iraq-Iran War. Middle classes and the elite of the Iraqi society found it very difficult to lead a normal life under the war conditions. And very slowly, many, as I said, middle-class people started to look to London as second home, sending their children, establishing some form of community. And it continued to grow, and it was enhanced by having thousands of political refugees. So we ended up with an established Iraqi community now in London.
What has life been like for you as an Iraqi in London during the war? And I wonder if you or other Arab friends have felt a sense of discrimination or hostility during the war.
I think we haven't felt yet that sense of hostility or discrimination. Our main concern, and it saddens us to a great deal, is to see the image of our country, Iraq, has been ruined. And in the eyes of the public, the image of Iraq has become that of Saddam Hussein and his thugs. And obviously, Iraq is very much a cultured country, a civilized country with a long-standing history and a very rich heritage. And to see all this not being mentioned and Iraq to be associated with what Saddam Hussein is doing is very, very sad. We, as I said, we wish we can tell the world that Iraq isn't like that. The Iraqi peoples are very peaceful people and they're very tolerant people. And Iraq has an awful lot to offer to the world other than having wars with Iran and with Kuwait and with this and that.
You're a civil engineer, and I imagine you must be especially concerned, well, I imagine all Iraqis are very concerned, about what it will take to rebuild Iraq after the war is over.
That is true. In fact, part of the reason why I moved from engineering into politics, because I saw that whatever I can do as an engineer to build Iraq, it can all be wiped off by the political instability that existed in Iraq. And unless we see political reforms, we see a stable Iraq, there doesn't seem to be much point in investing in other things. So I think the first concern is before we see physical reconstruction, it is vital that we see real reform in Iraq, that we see an accountable government, that we see the Arab Shias and the Kurds participating and having their share of power. And I think if we do that, Iraq itself is a rich country, and I do believe there is a goodwill from the world community towards Iraq, and hence Iraq can be reconstructed and rebuilt. But this, what is important is political reform must take place beforehand.
My guest is Laith Kuba, an Iraqi exile living in London, where he co-founded the Iraqi dissident group, the Democratic Reform Movement. More with Kuba in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on the Iraqi offer to withdraw from Kuwait?
Nearly a whole program is what we have about it. The Iraqis broadcast a communique this morning. It has been rejected because while it speaks of withdrawal from Kuwait and acceptance of the earliest of the UN Security Council resolutions, it also places very strict conditions on that, it seems, an Israeli withdrawal, and rather than restoration of the al-Sabah family to power in Kuwait, an election to determine who should govern Kuwait. We will be hearing a reaction to that from everywhere, the U.S., the Middle East, the Soviet Union, and we have quite a bit to hear about it.
Thanks, Robert. That's coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Laith Kuba, and he's the general secretary of the group, the Democratic Reform Movement. It's a group of Iraqi exiles, a pro-democracy group based in London. What's your position on the war in the Gulf?
The war in the Gulf, of course, we condemned Saddam's invasion to Kuwait, but we do not see that going into the war was the answer, neither to the problem of Kuwait, nor to the problems of the region, nor to the issue of Saddam Hussein himself. We believe that Saddam Hussein must not be given the chance to manipulate all these issues to his advantage, which what he is doing at the moment. By going to war against Saddam Hussein, the whole issue has been confused. Now he looks as if he is a hero, he is a martyr, he is a defender. It's a war between the Muslims and the Christians, between the Arabs and the Americans. And I think the whole agenda has been confused by going to war. We believe Saddam could have been suffocated out of power. There is enough forces within the country to oust him. And it would have taken some political work and some calculated moves in order to do it in its due course and it's in its time. The mistake has been that I think America wanted things to happen according to its own schedule, its own timing, and its own objectives. And things doesn't work like that in the Middle East, nor in Iraq.
The war seems to have increased
animosity toward America and Americans through the Arab world. What do you think of sentiment in Iraq? Do you think that the hatred is going to run very deep and very long?
Well, it is with deep, deep regret that the Americans muddled the politics in Iraq and in the region through going through this war. I think there has been some negligence and some ignorance that led to that. The region itself and Iraq is complicated with lots of historical issues, and Saddam Hussein is in a far better position to play his tactics and manipulate those issues to his advantage. So yes, regrettably, there is a strong sentiment against the Americans, and it'll take an awful lot of demonstration of goodwill in order to remove that. The Iraqis are not as simple, or they don't think in the same way like the Americans do. They don't follow the same logic. And I think what happened, as I said, will require a lot of goodwill and effort in order to cure it.
I'm wondering if you're frustrated at some of your fellow Arabs for having made Saddam Hussein into a hero.
I can understand them. I'm not actually frustrated about their attitudes. If you take, for example, King Hussein, or if you take President Chadli in Algeria, I think they're under tremendous pressure from the masses in the street. And the masses in the street do not see the reality of Saddam Hussein, but they see an emerging symbol, a symbol that is now associated with issues that matters to them. And in that respect, I mean, it's not their fault that Saddam is too clever to employ these issues and put pressure on their leaders.
Laith Kuba, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. Nice talking to you.
My guest has been Laith Kuba. He's an Iraqi exile living in London and co-founder of the dissident group, the Democratic Reform Movement. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Special thanks to Pat Ford, who joined us for a month to help produce our war-related programs. She has to move on, and we'll miss her. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, America's economy in the post-Cold War era. Economics writer Robert Kuttner returns to tell us why he thinks the end of the Cold War should also mean the end of laissez-faire. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.